It is Friday, October 14th in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. Coming up, the Islamic State group is feeling the pressure as U.S.-backed Iraqi forces surround its key power base in the city of Mosul. Did IS face a revolt within its ranks in Mosul? We'll get an update from our national security correspondent. We'll tell you why the death of Thailand's long-reigning king is prompting not just grief, but also anxiety. And a surprise Nobel Prize for Literature awarded to U.S. songwriter Bob Dylan generates debate.
I think the pressure that it exerts on the notion of what literature can be is crucial and is really timely.
It's all ahead on International Edition. The Reuters news agency is reporting that the Islamic State group has crushed a rebellion in the Iraqi city of Mosul, a rebellion apparently led by one of the group's commanders. The report quotes Mosul residents and Iraqi security officials as saying the rebellious IS fighters aimed to switch sides and help Iraqi government forces who have been preparing to oust the group from the city. For more on the situation in Mosul, I spoke earlier to VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden, and I asked him what he has heard about the Reuters report.
The Reuters report seems to be well-sourced, and clearly Islamic State has a history of brutally repressing any sort of dissent. Often you see it as they've been retreating and losing ground as U.S.-backed forces, coalition-backed forces have advanced, especially in Iraq, where at times, if they were unhappy with the way a town or a city was lost, those Islamic State fighters that fled often will be executed as traitors or as cowards. And at other times, just to make a point, if they're not happy with the decision, they've executed dozens of fighters or other bureaucrats that they may have. So that in and of itself is not unusual. The question is, how much of this, and it's always a question, how much of this is really about a rebellion that was taking place inside of Mosul that was timed to take place at the same time that coalition-backed forces finally moved on the city. I've heard from sources I've talked to that there are pockets of resistance in the city, that they were hoping to get more, perhaps get them some more backing. In the story reported by Reuters, apparently it was discovered because of a communication about weapons that were being hidden in the city. So it's very plausible there's dissent. Remember, Mosul has been occupied for 2 years. Islamic State, even though it's ruled it and it's built it as a paradise, has been brutal on the population. So clearly there's some anger, some angst. Perhaps people are trying to step up. How much of it is propaganda by the Islamic State trying to send a message to its own fighters elsewhere? Don't run. Don't flee. You follow your orders, fight until the death. And how much of it is propaganda by some of the U.S. and coalition-backed forces to show that Islamic State is weak and that it's falling apart, and now is the time to move to give its troops, its forces, more confidence right as they move on a city that U.S. and coalition officials have said Islamic State intends to turn into hell on earth?
Well, the U.S. and Iraqi forces are stepping up their attacks on the city. They haven't launched the full-scale assault yet. So what have you heard about their latest moves in the area around Mosul?
Well, just the latest release that was put out by the coalition about the airstrikes. There were five airstrikes that they said they carried out on Thursday against targets in and around Mosul. And some of these targets that haven't really shown up on the list before. Normally you see, okay, a fighting position, maybe a weapons factory or a weapons depot, fighters, but this one included trenches hitting various tunnels, which have been hit before. But the trenches stands out because Islamic State, in part of their effort to defend Mosul, has built, according to coalition forces, intelligence officials, a system of trenches, of pits filled with oil and tires that they're going to set on fire to make the fighting difficult. So it seems like the operation to retake Mosul is getting closer, is imminent. Just the other week, coalition forces spokespeople said that the last brigade, there are about 8 to 12 Iraqi brigades that are going to be used in this operation to retake Mosul. And the last of those brigades that was going to be involved was undergoing training, and that training is supposed to be finishing up within the coming week. So if you go along those timelines from what other officials have told us, it could be within days, it could be within weeks, but clearly the Iraqis are almost ready, on the verge of preparing their final assault on Mosul.
Thank you very much to our national security correspondent, Jeff Selden, for that update on the situation in Mosul.
Glad to have helped.
Well, let's get a look at the social media world now, and our social media editor, Andrew Polchevsky, is with me in the studio. Hey, Andrew. I understand,
Michael,
you've been looking at the latest on the U.S. election. What have you got?
Yeah, well, it's this issue of the sexual assault allegations against Donald Trump has continued to make headlines on social media, and we tend to see these hashtags pop up as this story evolves and develops. And so the two hashtags we're seeing today are hashtag women who vote Trump. Now, this is being
there used, are some of those?
There are some of those, and actually so it's being used in two different ways. There are women who are using this to say, I'm a woman and I'm still voting for Donald Trump despite these allegations, or I don't believe these allegations and I'm still choosing to support him.
Allegations of sexual misconduct.
Exactly. But then other people on the flip side are using it to say, hashtag women who vote Trump, why would you do this? And they're in disbelief that any women could be supporting Donald Trump currently. So it's being used on both sides, by some to justify their support, by others to question it. And then you have hashtag why women don't report. Now, this comes out of a hashtag we saw the other day that people were accusing these victims coming forward of being fake and wondering how many more fake victims would come forward. And this hashtag why women don't report is being used by sexual assault survivors and victims to talk about why they didn't report it, why it took them so long to report it, and may explain why it's taken these women with their allegations against Donald Trump so long to report their stories.
Of course, yeah, Trump's supporters say, you know, the timing is rather suspicious on those accusations.
Right, with the election coming up, of course.
Right.
And this hashtag seeks to shed some light on kind of the background of why these women may be coming
right
forward, that it's not necessarily because of the election or because of the, you know, they want to be in the limelight and have their 15 minutes of fame, which is one allegation that's been levied against them. It's everything from embarrassment to lack of resources to people who won't even listen. So a number of those women have said that it was some issues raised in the debate that drew them out and caused them to go forward. So that's hashtags being used to shed some light on that. And then since it is Friday, we'll end with a lighter note.
Great.
Hashtag, yes, hashtag National Dessert Day is today. So that's trending worldwide. So everybody,
I want something with chocolate.
Yes. And everybody around the world, go have some dessert. And in the U.S., we're going to have a great Friday because President Obama earlier today lifted the restriction on Cuban cigars and rum. So a lot of people really excited to get their weekend started with some Cuban cigars and rum. I don't know how quickly they'll be able to get them from Cuba to the U.S. Maybe not for this weekend.
Yeah.
But maybe as the holidays approach, might be a nice gift for somebody
tonight,
in a couple months.
I'm going to get a rum and coke to celebrate the weekend.
There
tonight.
You go. It's a good way to do it.
All right. Thank you so much, Andrew. If you want to follow Andrew on Twitter, he is at apal. I am at Michael_Lippin, and the show is at VOA_IE. Here are some of the top stories now on voanews.com. Syria's Aleppo bombarded in overnight airstrikes. U.S. President Obama further eases restrictions on U.S. trade with Cuba. Israel suspends cooperation with UNESCO after UN Cultural Agency adopts a resolution that says Israel denies the Jewish people's historic connection to Jerusalem. Pakistan Taliban gunmen target Pakistan security forces in Quetta, and Bermuda seeks quick recovery from Hurricane Nicole damage. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on voanews.com. This is International Edition. Let's have a look at the U.S. stock market now. The major U.S. stock averages were on track for their best daily gain of the month at the market open on Friday, but those gains have been scaled back by midday. With more on the Wall Street action, our business correspondent Jill Malandrino joins me now from New York. Hi, Jill.
Hey, Michael.
What happened to the market's early rally?
So the S&P 500, we came into the day on track for a weekly drop of 1% as of Thursday's close, while the Dow was off about 0.8%. The turnaround we saw this morning can be attributed to U.S. financials snapping a three-day losing streak as J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, and PNC earnings report solidly beat expectations, although they have come back in along with oil, and that's why we're seeing some gains paired here, but we are certainly well off the lows right now. China inflation data also helped ease some pressures on markets after weaker export data the day prior weighed heavily on metals and materials. In China, September producer prices unexpectedly rose for the first first time in nearly 5 years, and consumer inflation also beat expectations. So that eased some of the concerns about the health of the world's second biggest economy. Now, in just a few minutes at 1:30 p.m. Eastern, exactly 15 minutes, Fed Chair Janet Yellen will be speaking at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston's annual research conference. So anything can happen between then and the market close, because the market potentially will move off of headlines hitting the tape based on what she says.
And what kind of topics is she expected to address?
Traders will certainly be looking for clues into when we will get the next interest rate hike. It's basically off the table in November. There's a 70% chance we'll get that in December. So they're really going to listen to her remarks to gauge how she feels about economic data that has come out recently. We had a slightly weaker than expected jobs report, but retail sales was very, very good this morning at about 0.6%, and that was much higher than August. So we're slowly starting to see improved economic data, and the Fed remains data dependent, so that's what they're going to listen for.
Well, what is on tap for next week in terms of market-moving news?
All right, there's going to be plenty. Of course, the national election and interest rates will remain front and center, but earnings season will also be in full swing, and that's going to give traders something else to focus on besides macro. So we're going to see some good action and plenty of individual names. Key companies I'm looking for: Bank of America, IBM, Netflix, a widely popular traded name, Johnson & Johnson, eBay, Microsoft. You want to pay attention to what they're saying about virtual reality in the holiday shopping season. Honeywell and McDonald's. There's also a slew of semiconductors reporting, and that group has been super strong the past few months. It was up about 11 weeks in a row. I'm curious to see if there'll be any future impact from the Samsung fallout with the semis and suppliers. Now, Samsung slashed its quarterly profit estimate by a third, soaking up $2.3 billion of a hit from ditching its exploding flagship smartphone. And analysts believe this could be one of the costliest product safety failures in tech history. So the massive cut may slow down the company's product cycle and spending, which would spill over into the companies that make up Samsung's supply and distribution channels. So there could be some nice derivative tech plays off of that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to our business reporter in New York, Jill Malandrino. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Okay, moving on to Thailand and the death of Thai King Bhumibol, who reigned for 70 years, is causing concern in the kingdom and abroad. As VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Steve Herman reports from Silver Spring, Maryland, there are both immediate and long-term questions about the future of the Thai monarchy.
Grief, anxiety, and puzzlement are the dominant emotions enveloping Thais both home and abroad in the hours following the announcement that 88-year-old King Bhumibol Adunadet had died. It should have come as no shock. The monarch had been in poor health for years, and it was assumed that Thailand, under military rule since a coup 2.5 years ago, would race to name Crown Prince Vajiralongkorn as the next king. But that did not happen when the junta's hand-picked National Assembly hastily convened. Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha, who as army chief seized government power in the 2014 coup, says the heir apparent is not ready.
He asked for a delay in proclaiming him king and for it to be postponed to an appropriate time so he can mourn his father with the rest of the nation.
Journalist Paul Handley, the author of an unauthorized biography of the late king, which is banned in Thailand, calls this surprising and possibly dangerous.
It's raised questions of whether there's some kind of negotiations going on, and what that could be, we don't know, but it's not a good sign.
The crown prince has not been the recipient of adulation comparable to his father. He has spent much of his time in Germany, gaining a reputation for a more ostentatious and controversial lifestyle. Thais revered King Bhumibol, by contrast, for frequently going to meet farmers and poor villagers, his sleeves rolled up, a camera strapped around his neck, and a two-way radio on his belt.
They know that his successor can't fill those boots. They know that Prince Vajiralongkorn has never put himself out on royal missions, on rural development projects like his father did.
For now, among Thai expatriates, there is no communal outpouring of grief. Monks we spoke with here at this temple say they are awaiting instruction from Bangkok via the embassy. After all, it's been 70 years since the last king of Thailand died, and no religious leader is alive from that time
to explain the protocol. Steve Herman, VOA News, at Wat Tai, Silver Spring, Maryland.
Well, coming up after the break, scientists see a way to reach Mars via the moon. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists in Australia may have come up with a unique solution to fight antimicrobial resistant infections, or superbugs, a growing worldwide concern. The researchers found that star-shaped objects they created with short chains of proteins called peptide polymers might be able to replace traditional antibiotics. Doctors have long prescribed antibiotics to fight various bacteria-borne ailments from acne to pneumonia. But using these drugs repeatedly over time can cause many of these microbes to mutate and build a resistance against medications made to fight them. After testing their star-shaped peptide polymers on animal models, the researchers found them to be effective in killing superbugs. They also discovered that antibiotic-resistant microbes showed no signs of fighting this new treatment method. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. This week, President Obama reiterated his call for a U.S. mission to Mars, something he first proposed in 2010. Obama wants a government partnership with private sector companies to develop the means to send humans to and from Mars by the 2030s. But as VOA's Greg Flakus reports from Houston, some space experts think it would be better for humans to return to the moon first.
Since the last mission to the moon half a century ago, space enthusiasts have been talking about a trip to Mars. But lunar scientist Paul Spudis is among the experts who question the current plan to go there sometime after 2030.
Any program where the payoff is 20 to 30 years in the future is effectively a dead issue in Congress, because they don't deal on timescales like that. They deal on timescales of 2 to 10 years.
In his recently published book, The Value of the Moon, Spudis makes the case for establishing an outpost on the moon, which is relatively close by.
It's only 3 days to the moon and 3 days back.
What's more, he says, NASA missions prove that there's water at the moon's poles.
So I have energy and I have materials. I can live on the moon. I can make rocket propellant.
Electricity from solar cells can be used to separate the elements in water molecules.
By taking the hydrogen and oxygen from cracking the water and dissociating with electricity, and then freezing those gases into liquids, that's the most powerful chemical propellant we know of.
At a recent gathering of scientists and space enthusiasts at Houston's Rice University, former NASA astronaut Leroy Chow also supported going to the moon.
We can train crew, you know, we don't necessarily want the first crew on Mars to be rookies, so we can train crew on the moon.
But some question the idea of using the moon as a chemical refueling station.
If we talk about actually making the journey to Mars on chemical propulsion, that could be a dead end. We need high-speed transportation.
Paul Spudis says chemical fuel is well-tested and available.
The fundamental problem with a lot of the advanced propulsion concepts, for example, plasma rockets and nuclear thermal propulsion, is that they require technology that we don't have.
Spudis says robots can do much of the preliminary work on the moon, starting with tests of the polar water resource. But before such a plan can be carried out, either the United States, another country with a space program, or a private company will have to provide the money to get it started. Greg Flakus, VOA News, Houston.
The Swedish Academy has surprised the world with its decision to award the Nobel Prize for Literature to U.S. singer-songwriter Bob Dylan. Dylan was far down the list of predicted winners, which also included U.S. novelists Don DeLillo and Philip Roth. On Thursday, the Academy said it was honoring Dylan for having created new poetic expressions within the great American song tradition. Well, that unusual honor for a songwriter is generating some debate here in the U.S., as VOA's Zlatan Sahok reports.
Dylan's career spans more than half a century and attracts people of all generations. His fans say the award is well-deserved.
He's a very good creative songwriter, singer, guitarist. I guess he deserves it.
That's absolutely fantastic for him and all the efforts that he's put into providing fabulous music for over 50 years.
Dylan has received numerous music awards and has admirers among people like President Barack Obama and celebrities like Hollywood star Tom Hanks.
He shaped our generation, and he shaped the artistic response, the responsibility of artists, simply by being so authentic to his desire to tell the truth in song. And he's always writing songs, even now.
But for many people, Dylan is a musician and not an author. Social media was a Twitter Thursday questioning and even disparaging the choice. The controversy is a good thing, says Stephen Rings, music professor at the University of Chicago, who has taught a course on Dylan.
I think the pressure that it exerts on the notion of what literature can be is crucial and is really timely to rethink the idea that Bob Dylan is fundamentally a singer and a songwriter, and that the literary moment in that process of composition is critical.
So can we expect someone like American pop singer and songwriter Katy Perry to win a Nobel Prize in the future? Not necessarily, says Rings.
If it's Bob Dylan, that's one thing to give the Nobel Prize in literature. It's very different from giving it to just about any other musician in the post-war era.
Bob Dylan's handwritten manuscript for his song Like a Rolling Stone sold for over $2 million at an auction earlier this year, making it the most expensive rock music manuscript sold at an auction. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. Your director today was Patrice Martin. The engineer was Cornelius Tenner. And I'm Michael Lippin. You can follow me on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. And the show is there too at VOA_IE. So glad you could listen to us today. Hope you have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains committed to helping Afghanistan become a more secure and stable country, said Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan Richard Olson. In order to support Afghan security, President Barack Obama announced in July that the U.S. would keep a larger force on the ground in Afghanistan through 2016 than originally planned. And NATO allies and partners agreed to extend NATO's training mission and to fund the Afghan forces through 2020. In their second year on the job, the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces demonstrated greater discipline and capacity than ever before. The fight has not been easy. Afghan casualty levels are higher this year than last, said Mr. Olson. But the Afghan security forces continue to execute their campaign strategy and have demonstrated resilience in security operations around the country. U.S. forces also continue to disrupt and degrade ISIL. Counterterrorism operations against ISIL and the remnants of al-Qaeda continue to be a priority for the United States in order to ensure that Afghanistan never again becomes a safe haven for terrorists. Security in Afghanistan is closely tied to political stability. The U.S. remains firmly committed to the unity government established 2 years ago between President Ashraf Ghani and Chief Executive Abdullah. The U.S. continues to urge all parties to resolve their political differences peacefully and in a spirit of inclusivity. Afghanistan is a diverse country, and its citizens need and deserve a government that is effective and able to represent all elements of society, said Mr. Olson. It is critical that there be tangible progress on electoral reforms, a credible election timeline, and a reasonable plan to prepare for the constitutional Loya Jirga. On the plus side, the Afghan government completed its accession to the World Trade Organization in July, reflecting a commitment to fostering trade. The government also completed an International Monetary Fund program that resulted in increased revenue collection and a crackdown on corruption. The coalition that the U.S. and its allies have built and maintained through years of diplomacy, said Mr. Olson, will continue to stand side by side with the Afghan people as they chart a path toward a long-sought and long-overdue peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.